What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
Shout out to our sponsor, Wix.com. Go to Wix and build a website. Then come back and listen to this episode of Rebel Radio. I'm your host, Josh Levine. My guest today is Melanie Maras, quite possibly the funniest person in the world. She's a finalist in the Laugh Factory's Funniest Person in the World competition, representing her home country of Indonesia. Her comedy career is full of sex. She's got all kind of interesting one-woman shows, plays. She's the subject of a new documentary film, and then, of course, the Laugh Factory competition. She's got a lot of good stuff happening. She's going to tell us all about that, as well as giving us some important life lessons, career lessons, business advice, if you will. She's a great example of being vulnerable, of finding her own voice, and she's going to give us some tips on how to test your own boundaries. Good stuff coming up on Rebel Radio after our EDM.com track of the week. That was our EDM.com track of the week. That's Kyle Watson with a track called Watermelons. You can find that on First Edition label. Go to soundcloud.com/First Edition. And now let's hear the interview with Melanie Maras.
Nice. All right. You be funny, and we're just going to sit here and listen.
No pressure.
Done. And
yeah,
go.
Ready?
No, don't worry.
Hey, welcome.
Hi.
Josh, thanks for coming.
Josh is not very funny, so.
I'm not funny. I'm the not funny one. But so our guest today is Melanie Maras. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Wow.
Is it okay. How you say it?
It's okay.
That's how I say it when fine. People say Cassandra.
How about if you tell us how you say your name?
I just say Maras.
Maras. Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, you're really supposed to roll the R, but I don't. I myself don't even do that, so how could I ask anyone else to?
Well, our guest today is Melanie Maras, creator of the Red Flag play and lots of funny stuff online, which you can tell us all about. the Mayo Kama Sutra was highly disturbing.
What? So were you
we
disturbed
learn
by that?
About that a little bit. And apparently a funny storyteller. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, how do you guys know each other? Because we found
Bala.
You.
Yeah, we know each other through the magnificent Shelly Bala.
Yeah, my one Indian friend.
Is she your one Indian friend?
I'm sorry.
You need to get on top of that.
You only have one, so you rotate them?
Well, I once said that I have a lot of Indian friends, and then my boyfriend challenged me, and then I said, well, I just know Shelly Bala and Jay Bala. So I really don't know that many Indian people. So yeah, we know each other through a good friend who's her best friend, Shelly.
Well, there's only about a billion,
Bala?
Roughly. Indians. People in the world, so
I was like, ballas?
It's not surprising you would only know one.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know. Where are they in LA? How many Indian friends do you have?
A lot.
Okay. I'm gonna go home now.
Like at least one.
Yeah, so that's basically how we know each other. And then I went to her show and I was absolutely, actually,
you went to Red Flag.
I was so inspired. Yeah, I was so inspired. I left there and I was like, what am I doing with my life?
What?
I need to influence and impact people the way you did for me. And it was awesome. It spread that energy. And I was storytelling after sharing your stories.
All right. We're not here to interview Cassandra.
But I'm going to. I want her to jump into.
Well, tell us what Red Flag's about.
Yeah.
I watched some bits online.
Yeah.
But give it for anyone who may not have seen it yet.
Anyone who might not have seen it, which is most people, really. Let's be honest. Red Flag, it's a true story. And it's about... it's about a lot of relationships I've had in my life, but it's mostly about one relationship I had that sort of derailed my life. And it's about all those red flags that come up in a relationship that you kind of clock them and you're like, oh, but then you just keep going.
Sure.
so until to the point where it's just like, you know, you're like, oh, this is rock bottom.
Kind of like we're doing with this interview.
Yeah.
We're just ignoring all the red flags. Keep going.
Yeah.
Wait, am I the red flag?
So it's about that. And I mean, but ultimately if I did my job and I wrote it properly, the real question is like, the real red flag is me, you know? It's like, that's like the common denominator in like all of like these crazy relationships and all these crazy scenarios.
Sure.
So.
And is that like the lesson that we want the audience to take? Is that like...
I mean, there's
in the mirror first.
There's like a lot of lessons. It's okay. Like don't date guys with long hair. Don't like if your boyfriend
man buns.
Check.
Yeah,
let me write that down. Man buns.
I mean, I quite
Is
like
that
a man
thing?
Bun,
but he's got long hair. If he has, man
well, bun. I mean, he had like hair down to his bottom.
We're talking about like a hair,
like we're
a
talking
bun
about,
of
oh,
hair.
We're talking about like hippie hair.
Like we're talking like hair down to his ass. Like don't date a guy with hair down to his ass. That's a red flag. That's red flag number one.
Yeah.
Number two, if he gives you chlamydia, don't keep dating him. Run away.
Well, maybe he's not going to give it to you again.
What else?
Yeah, that's
I
a
like
good
those
one.
Tips.
Those are
you
good.
Like, do you like those tips?
I don't know. Those seem a little. They seem a little obvious.
So, where did? I mean, I thought the whole show was pretty ballsy. You know, you really went up there and exposed yourself and told these stories. And where did you get the balls to do that?
You know, I actually it didn't really hit me the sort of the vulnerability of the whole thing of like getting on stage and you know talking about your most personal, most private moments until I had an ex-boyfriend come to the show.
Not the guy.
It was a guy who was in the show, but it wasn't like the main guy.
Right.
And he didn't tell me that he was coming and he sat in the back and I didn't see him. And like afterwards he texted me and told me he had come and I literally had a panic attack. Like I gave myself explosive diarrhea. And that's when I was like, oh my God. I was like, I can't believe like I get on stage and I say all these things in like front of all these people. Like what's wrong with me? So that was the only moment where it really hit me. Outside of that, it felt very natural.
But hearing that and that happening to you, did that impact the rest of your performances?
Yeah, they were probably like just went really downhill after that. Like, I'm sorry for anyone who came after that show.
For that night.
Every night.
It was running, you know, like a couple weekends, right?
Yeah. That's funny. And so, what drove you to, how did it come together? Like what drove you to create it?
This relationship I had that kind of really derailed my life. I just to sort of heal myself, I started to write the show. But I started to write the show really casually, without any kind of intention. And then I took this solo show class with Lauren Weedman, who's an incredible storyteller. And so then I like wrote it a little more seriously, and then like a little more seriously, and then I stopped writing it altogether. And I have a theater company in New York called Inviolate, and they have a retreat every year. And last summer they had their playwriting retreat, and my friend Bixby Elliott was like, you have to come and you have to bring your solo show. And he basically nagged me every day to the point where I was like, I just bought a plane ticket to shut him up. I was like, I'm only buying a plane ticket to come to this so that you will stop bothering me about it. And I was like, and I'm only coming for 24 hours.
What do you think he saw?
I don't know. You know how you have your friends that are really your champions and they just believe in you and... He's one of those for me.
I don't have any of those. No.
You have Cassandra?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. My one Indian friend. And Cassandra.
Well, I'm not Indian, but
not Indian.
Fine.
But yeah, so then I went to the retreat and I had maybe 30 minutes of the show at that point. And I read it really nervously off my iPad, you know, shaking and the response that the audience gave me, and the audience was really a small group of people who I know very well. They're in my theater company. Mm-hmm. But all the love and the enthusiasm, and like I could feel them go on the journey with me. And they really gave me all the motivation I needed to just start to move it forward and to start working towards a production and finish it and get it up on its feet and show it to the world.
Yeah.
What is your, I mean, I don't know, this question's kind of funny, but what's your mission as a storyteller?
My mission as a storyteller? My mission as a storyteller is to touch people and to illuminate humanity. And that's it, really.
You do that well.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, what's it like dating while you're doing that show?
You know what's interesting is that I thought that men would see the show and just be like... terrified, like just you know, yeah, just like they'd just be so afraid.
Yeah.
But I had so much interest from like people who came to the show.
You were so funny
because you're on stage,
and she's so real and raw. I think people like dig that, you know, when you're so like, that's
they see you. The dollar signs. Come and get me some of that red flag money.
So, oh yeah.
So any so is that like the success of the show is maybe a potential husband?
I don't know that I would call that the success of the show. But it wasn't. I thought it would be like a real deal breaker for people, and it really wasn't.
So it had no effect. Is that what you're saying?
It had no negative effect.
Right.
Okay.
No negative effect.
That's good.
All right.
Yeah.
So like a guy came up to you from the audience afterwards. It's like, hey, I really liked your show.
Here's my number. Kind
of, yeah.
Let's do this.
Does that happen?
I want to be number 7 on this chapter.
Do you have somebody picking guys out of the audience to bring backstage?
No, but that's a fabulous idea for the next run. Josh, that can be you. That could be your job.
Oh, yeah. I'd love that.
Yeah.
Sure. No, yeah. That's not, I'm not the guy
He's
for that.
He's not the
no?
guy for that.
No? No.
You need the guy from the plane to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So any surprising feedback that like kind of you weren't expecting?
Well, I think I was really expecting people to be so offended and like repulsed, and I didn't receive that. So that was the most surprising thing to me.
Really?
Really. Yeah.
What do you think you would have done had that happened?
Just been apologetic. Sorry, I'm alive. Sorry I was born.
So a lot of your stuff is sort of like that. It's like very in your face. It's very raw in some ways, like, you know, Kama Sutra, male. What's the inspiration? Is it mostly ex-relationships?
What happened?
What went wrong?
You know, I think that when I was growing up, my parents were super overprotective, like just, you know, not like beyond like tiger mom, like just another level, or like helicopter mom or whatever.
So you moved here from Indonesia, right?
I grew up in Indonesia.
Okay.
My dad's from Indonesia. My mom's from Oklahoma, and they're both from like very small towns. So like my dad's from a really small town in Indonesia. My mom's from a really small town in Oklahoma. So they both are hyper conservative, and they're older as well. So they're from a different world, literally.
How are small town Indonesia and small town Oklahoma alike?
I think people are simple-minded and in both places.
We have a lot of listeners in Indonesia, by the way, so they'll be interested to hear this.
Great.
Yeah.
I think that it's like if you grow up in a small town with limited beliefs, it's hard to look beyond that, and it's hard to grow and think of any other way of life because you've never seen anything else. So those were my parents, and I think that just don't lock your kids up because they will end up like me.
But you're awesome.
So it's a cautionary tale.
It's a cautionary tale.
So wait, and then so you came from, you know, another part of the world. How'd you get into storytelling and comedy and writing and all that?
You know, I didn't get into storytelling and comedy until about 5 years ago, I took a storytelling class when I was living in New York with Kevin Allison, who he used to be on The State, and he has an amazing podcast called Risk and an amazing storytelling show called Risk. And he really had the first storytelling podcast of note. And well, besides The Moth, of course, after The Moth. So I took the storytelling class with Kevin, and it was the first time I realized I was like, oh, like, I'm a comedian, you know, like I didn't know before. It was so obvious, but really? I didn't realize it. And then, you know, writing stories and performing them, it was so natural to me. It was the most organic type of writing I had ever done. And I picked it up so quickly, and like the audience response was always like so tremendous. From the very first time I told a story, I was like, oh, you know, I think I should keep doing this.
Yeah. Mostly about your family?
No, I've never actually written about my family. It's almost always about, you know,
guys.
Sometimes girls, okay. You know, but mostly guys.
Yeah. It's funny that, you know, I think in the storytelling environments, The Moth, and I've heard some Moth speakers talk about the experience and, you know, how different it is from, say, like stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I think in a comedy club, the audience is kind of against you, like until you win them over.
I think they can be really hostile. Audiences in stand-up.
Whereas at places like The Moth, I think it's much more, tends to be much more supportive.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So have you bombed?
Mm-hmm. Have I bombed? Yeah. I mean, even doing my solo show, there would be nights where it's like the audience was just not responsive, and it's like they inform the show so much, like their responses, and it really sets the tone for everything. So if you're like not getting anything, and everyone experiences in their own way, like not everyone is a laugher or whatever, that doesn't mean that they're not with you or they're not enjoying it. And like some audiences are like really noisy and like knocking over beer bottles and
arguing with the waitress.
So it's I'm not at a point where that doesn't affect me.
Sure.
So how do you recover when you have, you know, let's say you don't have a great show, like how do you recover from that?
In the moment or afterwards?
After. When you go in your room.
Oh, I mean, you just, you know,
drink.
Wish you were dead, you know, wonder why you're alive, like, don't ever want to do it again. You're like, what's wrong with me? Why did I choose this? And then you just do it again.
Right.
So, but how do you get through it on stage, right? So you had a show last night and the audience was really into it. And now tonight, you know, it's the same material and you're just not getting it. And like, so what do you do in that moment?
I try to be present in every moment so that every moment is alive and real for me. I'm with varying degrees of success.
Sure.
And I just try not to get too in my head, because like in my head, it's like, oh my God, just leave. Just walk. Just go home. They hate you.
Yeah.
Just find a manhole to just throw yourself into. So I try to like just quiet those voices and just be as like, you know,
positive.
Yeah, as honest and open and vulnerable as I can be in the moment, and like hope that I can.
Is it hard to date when you're like a comedian in going through? Because it feels like it is a lot of ups and downs. A lot of people say it, you know. Is it hard?
Yeah, I mean, I think that anybody who's a creative has that, and it's like every time you finish a project, you know, you're like, what am I going to do next? You know, there's not that constant, steady, anything. And I realize, and I don't know that this is so much a problem for like male comedians. Like male comedians really crush a lot of ass.
Yeah.
But if you're a woman and you get on stage and you talk about your personal life in an irreverent manner, like men are really afraid of that. Like, and men are all, sorry. Men are all sort of so self-important that they always assume that you're gonna talk about them.
You know? I don't know. I've never dated a comic, so I have no idea if I would assume that.
Yeah.
Interesting. What are you looking at?
that card.
Oh, yeah. So tell us about the Male Kama Sutra.
What would you like to know about it?
What was the... Why? What
why?
Drove you to make that?
You know, that's something I've wanted to do for a long time. Super passionate about it.
So what? Give us the pitch.
So the Male Kama Sutra is a tongue-in-cheek comedic video, and it's about all those sexual, quote-unquote, positions that you hear about, like the Cleveland Steamroller, or the Houdini, or the Donkey Punch is a popular one.
Sure.
I may need to read that book.
Of course.
But so there are all these sexual scenarios where you
those are actually not in the Kama Sutra.
Okay. Yes.
That's a different.
Yeah. That's okay. A different text. Yeah. But so there are all these sexual positions wherein you either, you know, beat a woman, completely defile her, or murder her, you know, and like people think they're hysterical and they're so funny. And there's no reverse, you know, there's no female one where it's like the one where you like, you know, sit on a guy's face and then you pour like liquid Drano down his mouth, you know, like,
sure.
Yeah, and then call it the plumber. There's that. Nobody talks about
that. No, because guys make those stupid things up.
Exactly.
Right.
So I just, for me, I thought it would be very entertaining to, you know, do a few of these, some of my favorites, the jelly donut. That's pretty top notch. And call it the Male Kama Sutra.
Okay.
I mean, it's pretty fratty humor, I think. Yeah. I don't know. I liked it.
What'd you use for the jizz?
Oh, that's a really good question. Okay. So my friend Bixby Elliott taught me how to make fake jizz. I guess he may or may not have spent some time on a porn set as a PA. But so what you want to do is you want to get a white lotion. I use Lubriderm. And you want to add some water to it in a shaker. See the shaking motion I'm doing with my hand?
You know, can we grab the shake weight? We have that. It's around here somewhere.
Do you have a shake weight?
Oh, yeah. It's a prop.
Just carry down. Warm up.
And the amount of water you would add would just be... That would relate to the consistency you want, like how thick or how thin you want it. And then, this is key, you add a little bit of cooking oil to give it that viscosity.
Mm.
You know, that sort of shiny kind of...
Yeah.
I get what shiny
texture.
Means. Yeah.
I used grapeseed oil, but you could use whatever oil you have in your
That's
kitchen.
High end.
Yeah, I mean,
you
it's
spend
light.
A lot of money on
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
It's a big budget production.
Great for cooking eggs also.
Yeah.
So you shake that all together and voila.
Boom.
Semen.
So they used fake jizz on porn sites?
Is this surprising to you?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Do they? I thought everything was
That's
real.
Not common knowledge.
Oh, whoops.
Really?
Sorry.
You're spilling an industry secret right
now. Whoops.
Do you guys know that? Yeah. There's a guy with a little gun, like, hiding behind
like,
the
boom,
actor.
Got like, it. Hit her right on the spot. Okay.
Really? That's fascinating. Yeah, the consistency was probably what was most disturbing.
Which means you did it well.
YouTube actually flagged my video.
As inappropriate.
As inappropriate, and I've protested to no avail. I haven't heard anything back.
So is it down right now? We can't.
Well, no. You can still watch it. It's just age restricted, so you have to be signed into YouTube to prove that you're over 18.
Right.
Hey, let's promote the channel.
So did you get any?
No,
like,
what's the channel?
My YouTube channel is Miss Trouble Jones.
Miss Trouble Jones.
Yes.
And you're Trouble Jones on Twitter.
I'm Trouble Jones on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay.
Did somebody give you that name or you gave it to yourself?
Oh, I gave it to my own self.
Mm.
Yeah.
Why Trouble Jones?
I feel like Trouble Jones is my alter ego. And Trouble Jones is kind of like me, but, you know, without any conscience or like regret.
Okay.
So do
kind
we...
of girl who gives a guy a jelly donut. I guess.
Well, I mean, not yet. But
in theory,
let's not cross it off the list.
Okay.
You know?
Sure.
So how long have you had this alter ego? Is it as long as you've been working in the comedy writing space?
I probably started using it when I lived in New York, but then I didn't really I didn't start to use it all the time until I started to get into Twitter and Instagram and then I was kind of like, oh, this is good, I can hide, but then everybody knows that I'm Trouble Joan, so I can't hide from anyone.
So, but is that a real thing? Like, do you
yeah, I was just gonna...
do you kind of get into this Trouble Jones mindset, and like is that a persona in your mind that you create from? Or is it just a Twitter handle?
It's not just a Twitter handle.
It's none of my business.
No, I mean, I think that there's definitely moments in my life and activities from my life that have been like way more Trouble Jones than me, you know? I used to drink really heavily. And
Do you want a cocktail?
Participated in some recreational drug use, but I haven't had a drink.
Like steroids?
like mushrooms.
I love mushrooms.
No, not anymore.
Oh, but yeah, I mean, I haven't like, I've been like clean for like 10 months.
No, it's okay. I mean, I love mushrooms too.
I know. I actually want to do them maybe on my birthday.
Oh, well. I don't want to be locked in a car for hours again, so.
Oh, no.
No, it's bad.
Is that what happened?
I don't know. I just, I don't know.
Tell us about that.
Nah.
Hey, check it out. Rebel Radio is brought to you by Wix.com. Do you need a website? No, let me tell you, you do need a website, and you can do it yourself with Wix.com. No matter what business you're in, if you got a startup, your music career, your earwax collection, I don't know what you're doing. Whatever it is, you need a website. And Wix is used by more than 84 million people worldwide. It makes it easy to get your website live today. You can spend time on your business. Don't spend time building your website. There's hundreds of designer-made templates to choose from. Use the drag-and-drop editor. You drop in your images, your videos, your copy. And next thing you know, you have a beautiful website that you built yourself. It's fast. It's easy. It's free. We did it with rebelradio.net. Check it out. And you can see the amazing work you can do with Wix.com. You're too busy with everything else? Stop worrying about your website. Wix.com, it's easy and free. Go to Wix.com. Create your own website today. Send it to us, and we will promote it online. All right.
Okay. So writing, performing, which do you prefer? Let's break this up.
Okay, we can move past the mushrooms if that's what you'd like to do. So what do I prefer, writing or performing?
Or both.
I would say, I mean, I only like to perform my own writing, so I think it's probably 50-50.
Why is that?
Because I think that's when I'm my best self.
Okay. You talk a lot about sex.
Do I?
What's that about?
I mean, I think it goes back to like growing up very, 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 you know,
repressed,
very sheltered, very conservative.
Preacher's daughter kind of thing.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, not quite. My dad's Muslim. But my mom is, I grew up in a Baptist church in Indonesia. And I mean, like really like old school style Baptist. And I like wasn't allowed, there was a certain point in time where the only social activity I was allowed to do outside of school activities was like I could go to youth group. And like that was it. Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, and like my parents were just like, they would just be like, you're a whore, you know, and like I'd be like, had never even like been alone in a room with a boy, you know what I mean?
They
like
were just terrified of the idea of it happening.
Yeah, they'd be like, ah, you're a slut, you know. I'd be like, really? I'm like, guess what? No one wants to touch me. So I think that it's like because I was so repressed and I was so on lockdown, like I was just so determined to completely explore
sexy time,
that life, you know. I've never been like a sex worker or anything. Not that I'm against sex workers. That's fine.
Try it and come back on the show. Tell us how it is.
I mean, I went through a real phase where I was like, oh, I'm gonna moonlight as a dominatrix. But then I didn't move forward with it because I was like, oh, my clientele, like, what will they be like? You know what I mean? Is it going to be like just some really repulsive creature, and then it's like I have to urinate on him? Like, I mean, what I actually like thought about doing it, I was like, I don't. This is not
like you made a list.
Hot. What was the part that you thought you would enjoy?
Yeah, being this alter ego.
I don't know. I think I liked the outfits a lot. I mean, everyone likes a little light BDSM. I think I was like excited about the dominating part of it, but I just think the logistics of it. Hmm. No.
Are you very dominating in relationships? Like, are you the one saying, like, we're doing this, we're going here?
I have been, but I would really like, I'd like to be with like a man who leads. Like, I'd love to be with a man who could like whoopish me.
Yeah.
But a lot of relationships, like, it's different in the relationship than in sex, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, sometimes people switch roles.
Yeah.
I don't do that.
What's it like for you?
No, I'm the dominant one in my marriage. Definitely. We have a good, like, you know, we understand the roles, and everybody works for everybody.
And you have, like, a traditional marriage?
Yeah. I guess so.
You hesitated.
No, I don't.
We're learning a little bit more about Josh every episode. So.
No, I mean, I never thought about like in those terms. But yeah, I mean, yes, traditional marriage.
So wait, what do your parents think about your material? Do you show them?
Did they come to your show?
Oh my God, no.
So is it totally secret? Do they not have internet?
Well, my mom doesn't know how to use the internet. Thank God. and I think my dad is just kind of like too self-consumed to like Google me. So, you know, I'm not hiding anything, but I also don't, I'm not like sending them videos of my material. They didn't see the male Kama Sutra. And if they did, it was not because I sent it to them.
Are they the ones who flagged it on YouTube?
They like, we work for YouTube now.
Yeah.
So wait, because we get a lot of letters from people who want to become dominatrixes.
And do you?
Yeah,
really?
You'd be surprised.
No, come on.
And they don't know how. So how are you going to go about it?
Well, there was a club in New York where dominatrixes, I don't know what the plural is, where they work. So I was
crazy
just,
people, whatever.
I was just going to investigate. I was going to investigate that.
Okay.
I mean, I would think
it's not like on Meetup or something.
I think probably in this day and age, it's really easy to figure out like how to become a dominatrix. And it's like, I'm sure you could just start your own shop, you know, like your own website and just start soliciting clients. I don't think you need any kind of certification. Mm. I don't know how safe that is. I wouldn't advise anyone.
You need
to
like
do
a
that.
Lot of gear though, right? You can't just like.
It's probably really expensive. I'd be like, fuck
you can't
this.
Just start beating someone with a stick. Or, like
damn, I can't.
You need like contraptions.
I don't think you need that many contraptions.
Okay.
We gotta change it up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people are simpler than we anticipate. But maybe, what do I know? I've never been a dominatrix.
Maybe you should start like a web series on like how to become a dominatrix, and you can charge for that.
Is that a service?
I don't know.
Is that what you'd be interested in?
No, I actually don't want to be a dominatrix. That's not
so
really my thing.
All right. So a lot of your material is inspired by sex and, you know, ex relationships. Do you feel like Red Flag is a turning point in those, are you going to continue doing the same thing, or are you shifting and maybe
like, do you go now just have a relationship and then come back and do a new show?
Like, are you going to keep this whole Trouble Jones thing going to fuel your material?
Well, I definitely, I don't, I very, there's very few times in life where I'll do things to get material.
Right. Sure.
I mean, we all have our moments, you know, but.
Give us one. Tell us one thing you did just to get material.
Now I'm blanking. But anyways, those moments are few and far between.
Right.
I would say that Red Flag is a turning point for me because it's the most true to my voice. It's the most true to my point of view. And I think that the problem I've had with my writing in the past is I've tempered it and I've taken too many people's notes and like it just causes the writing to fall on its face, you know. And also I think that Red Flag's a turning point because everything I've done before this was sort of like quite lighthearted, and I went to like a far deeper place with this, and I think I'm just going to continue to go in that direction.
So let's talk about that. You know, getting notes and feedback and whatever. You know, how do you know what to listen to and what to ignore? And
I mean, I think you just have to really follow your intuition, because some notes can transform a piece of writing and make it so much better than what it was and are really necessary. And other notes, it's like, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, you're the writer. It's your voice. It's your story. You have to listen to yourself.
How long does it usually take to write your stories?
I guess it depends on the length of the story. Like a 5 or 10 minute story, I could write in, you know, less than a week. But, you know, my solo show was like 90 minutes that I probably worked on it for close to a year and a half.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
So, and how big is that for you? Like how, in your mind, sort of how successful was Red Flag, and what does that do for the next phase of your career?
I mean, Red Flag was successful in that there was, that I set this goal for myself and I did it. I never dreamed that I'd be able to, you know, write a show, get it produced, stand on stage for 90 minutes and actually capture an audience. So in that way, it was a success for me. And also, I mean, there was quite a lot of interest in my writing and whatnot from there. I mean, I made a lot of changes after the show. I like fired my managers. Like, I think it gave me a lot of more confidence in myself, and in my writing and what I'm capable of and what I can accomplish. You know, I mean, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about like what not to ever do again. And I'm hoping to do the show in New York and like, you know, do a complete rewrite on it and have like a whole new team of people work on it and just have it be really next level. And I'm working on a couple of TV pilots now. Like one of them is sort of based on my character in Red Flag. And then another one's based on my family. So, nice. Yeah, I mean, it's just been a lot of like momentum that's built up, a lot of stimulus, and it's kind of been a real engine for me. Yeah.
So is that like is it a bunch of little small steps that you kind of like, are there moments where you notice like, oh, I'm here and I used to be there. Like, does that stand out at all?
Yeah, I think so. I think that I feel different now. I feel different than when I moved to Los Angeles a few years ago. And when I first moved here, it's like I wasn't confident in my work. I didn't know what I was capable of. And now it's like I know what I'm walking into a room with. And I know what I want. I want people to meet me on my level. And it's like, you're either going to meet me on my level or you're not, you know, right. It's like buy, sell, or get out of the way.
Sure. So can you think of when that happened? Like does like a switch go off?
I think it was after I did my show, and like audiences started to come and I started to feel the response and like everything that the audience gave me and, you know, it was the audience gave me the confidence. Yeah.
Was there stuff that you thought was like going to kill and it just, I mean, you know, you talked about it's different night to night, but like, you know, can you think of some material that you're just like, this is gold, and then it just doesn't go?
I mean, I think my point of view is really, really specific, and sometimes like people don't know what I'm talking about. They have no idea. It makes so much sense to me. And the thing I guess that was even more surprising is there were moments that I would just skim over. I didn't think that they were moments that had any meaning or weight or humor at all. And like audiences would just love them so much.
So what's one of those?
Well, I mean, now I can't think of any. But they were there.
Okay.
So New York, you're taking Red Flag. You're going to change it a little bit. Now, doing the solo thing, was that like all you always knew it was going to be that type of show? Did you ever think about bringing in characters?
I mean, I hadn't, no. Really, like, my inspiration was Mike Birbiglia. He's my all-time favorite storyteller and comedian. So I would just listen to his albums and watch his live show on Netflix, like, over and over and over and over again. Hmm.
What is it about his stuff that connects with you?
I think he's a master storyteller because he starts off in this way that's, like, so, you know, kind of, like, unassuming and, like, casual. And it's, like, and he tells you this whole story. And like, and every bit of it is, like, interesting and draws you in. And there's moments of humor and there's moments of real humanity. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, and then it's, like, at the end, everything comes full circle. And it's, like, it just hits you like a ton of bricks. And you're, like, oh, my God. Mm. You know? And it's, like, this thing that you're, like, I'm having so much fun. And then you're, like, oh, I just live through something with you.
Anybody else that comes to mind that's been a big influence on you?
I love Louis C.K.
Yeah, he's awesome.
I love Larry David. I liked Margaret Cho in the early days when she was doing like Drunk with Power and I'm the One That I Want and then Notorious C.H.O. Then she went in a direction that I can't speak to.
Oh, I don't know what she's doing now.
But yeah, no, I mean, those comedy albums were just, and also she too had these moments that were just so revealing and so vulnerable and so raw. And seeing a woman do that, especially like an Asian woman, was just, that was very inspiring for me. But yeah, when I was little, my first comedy influence was John Cleese. There was an American club in Jakarta where I grew up and they had this video library and it was all these videos on VHS and you could rent videos from there. I mean, there was also like all these, you know, these little ghetto video places where it's like they like have these Betamaxes and these VHSs of like all these
bootlegs,
like all these bootleg like Hollywood movies. But I like the American Club was like my jam because they also had like these Oreo milkshakes that they would make there and you couldn't buy Oreos in Indonesia. They like got them at the U.S. commissary. So it's like, I was like, like, I'm going to get this at the bootleg place. So they had the Fawlty Towers series and I would rent them over and over and over and over and over again. And my favorite episode was called The Kipper and the Corpse and I transcribed it with a number 2 pencil. And then I convinced my teacher to let me go around to like other 5th grade classrooms and like reenact it. And like I played Basil Fawlty.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
And it's so weird because it's like when I started listening to Marc Maron's podcast, WTF, I realized that that is something that lots of comedians do as kids is they transcribe stand up and they transcribe like shows that they love. Like that was like a really common
That's funny.
Practice. Yeah. And I had no idea.
I never did that, but I used to memorize.
Yeah.
I used to sit and listen to Richard Pryor or Eddie Murphy, you know, on vinyl.
Oh, wow.
Or Robin Williams, Steve Martin, and just like memorize. And I'd go to school the next day and I would tell these jokes. And you know, not as if they were my own, but I'm like, oh, let me tell you. Or Dr. Demento was a huge, you're probably too young.
I don't know who that is.
It was this weird radio show, weekly Sunday evening radio show that was like weird. It was a mix of stand-up comedy and like recorded, you know, like stuff off of comedy albums.
Okay.
Just weird comedy radio on like K-Rock or something. Anyway, but I would sit and just memorize bits and like go to school the next day and do it.
And how would they land?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was like 11. They're fine.
Where were you living?
In San Francisco.
Oh, so I mean, kids are pretty progressive in San Francisco.
Yeah, no, I mean, it worked.
Yeah.
I didn't have like a big crowd. But it was just, you know, a couple of my buddies. Like, here's what I heard last night.
So did you ever want to be anything else beside a writer or comedian?
Oh God, the list is so long.
Really?
What were you doing before 5 years ago?
I was working in
Dominatrix.
That was just a pipe dream. I was working in production, and before that I was doing acting. And like I went through this phase, this like very fervent phase where I was like, I'm gonna be a professional matchmaker. And
nice.
I was obsessed with Patty Stanger. And like on Craigslist, I found this job like to work with Patty Singer, The Millionaire Matchmaker. And I went and I met a couple of people who were on the show at the time. I'm not really sure what's happening with the show now. And I met them at like this coffee bean in Burbank. And what they wanted me to do is they wanted me to go to bars, restaurants, nightclubs, grocery stores, synagogues, I don't know, just all over like Southern California. They were like, don't limit yourself to LA. And they wanted me to approach strangers and go up to them and be like, hi, are you single?
You're right.
And nice. Of course, like, I started doing this, now I was like, this is,
I started doing it and I was like,
this is a terrible idea.
Why is it such a bad,
matchmaking service?
Well, they were,
they want to get like the rejects too.
I mean, yeah. The thing is like, they obviously use a casting agent for it. So why they had like me,
but it wasn't to go drum up business for the matchmaking service.
No, it was to get guys on the show, which was like very bizarre. And it was like, and I was in the West Hollywood area a lot. And there was probably three guys I went up to who were like, the casting director for Millionaire Matchmaker already contacted me. Like, I'm not going to do the show.
We're crossing each other's territories. Yeah.
That's why they said get out of LA.
No, right. So wait, why was it so bad?
Well, it was just bad because like people would be like, you know, are you a prostitute? Like, what is this service you're soliciting? Like, you're trying to get me on a reality show. Like, I'm not going to do
really
it,
want me.
You know, but like, what's your deal? Like, what are you doing tonight? Yeah. You know? And it's just, it's a bad position.
How long
is that,
last?
Is that how you met the hair bun guy?
No.
That would have been cool.
Dare we say his name?
Yeah, what's his name?
No.
What's his Twitter handle?
What's his Twitter handle? Yeah. I don't know.
Did he come to the show?
I don't believe so.
You know, not that you know of.
Not that I know of.
You didn't look out and see him.
I didn't look out and see him. But you know what's really crazy? I had not seen him since this moment that I describe in the show that's really dramatic, where we are just yelling at each other on like Black Brand Sweet Surf for like hours. And that was 2 years ago, and I hadn't seen him. And then the day of my first show, the day that like my show opened, I moved recently to an anonymous location. And my parking space is off of like an alley, and I live in kind of like it's just kind of like a random area with not a lot of foot traffic. And I pull out and he's standing on my street corner.
Oh, wow.
That is so freaky.
And it was really bizarre. And I was like, oh, like my body had a response to it.
Yeah,
I was
of course.
Like, that's him. You know, like I saw his back was turned to me. I just saw the man bun, you know, but I knew. And then it's like he turned and there was this moment where he kind of like looked in the car and then he like turned away. And of course, he was like with some girl who kind of looked like me. And I had this moment because I was like, what do I do? Like, what's the protocol? Like, nobody prepares you for these moments. I'm like, should I stop the car? Like, should I say hello? Like, should I give him a flyer for my show? Should I hit him with my car? Like, what do I do? And like, I couldn't figure out what to do, so I just kept driving. Thank God the light was green.
That's crazy.
But
that's so crazy.
That was really strange.
What do you do before your shows? How do you get ready?
I would try to like have like a calming, grounding moment. Definitely pray a lot, like really hard. And
is it Muslim prayer or Baptist prayer? Or do you just cover
is
both?
Is it both?
You do.
Probably a Christian prayer, you know.
Okay. Not Baptist though.
Do you
speak in tongues before the show?
No. Not this time.
Okay.
Maybe next time.
All right.
I mean, I pace a lot. There's a lot of pacing.
Yeah, sure. Just going through the lines.
Yeah.
How do you practice at home, like saying the lines out loud over and over and over and over again?
I when I was memorizing it, yes, for sure, I did.
Yo, I hope you're enjoying this interview with Melanie Maras. We got some other great comedians we've had on the show. If you look back in our iTunes or our SoundCloud page, check out the one with my guest, Kira Sultanovich. She is another hilarious comedian, and we mix it up a little bit on that one. You might like it as well. Now back to Melanie Maras.
All right, I want to go back to the hair bun because, well, you know, the show's Red Flags, right? So Because I feel like, I mean, I've never dated a man.
Yeah.
But I feel like if I were that, you know, the hair bun would be a deal breaker for me.
Would it? I mean, it's so popular now, the man bun.
Yeah, but his was like, his would have been like the one where you bun it and it like.
I don't know. I can't imagine.
No, it's really popular right now.
It's really popular.
It has like its own hashtag.
Yeah, and it's like guys who like are like rocking a man bun with like sideburns and like a beard.
Oh, it's
like
getting crazy.
That's what, like, especially in Venice.
I think sideburns would probably be a deal breaker for me too.
I don't know. I'm not.
Here's
the
thing. I think anything with a hashtag would be a deal breaker for me.
Well, then it's too cool, and then you got to shave it. You know.
I don't know.
Then it gets like that. Because then if you do have
so
a man,
what's a deal breaker now? Now that we've learned these lessons,
okay.
What are the deal breakers? Okay, if a guy, you meet a guy, we've talked about this one,
mm-hmm.
and he texts you and there's an emoji in the text, does that kill the deal?
No.
Or that's still okay?
I like emojis.
You do?
Yeah,
I like a man who uses emojis.
I don't mind it, but he's like, smiley face. Ugh. No guy puts a smiley face. I'm like...
Like, that's, no real man uses a smiley face? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. You said you like a sort of a take charge man.
In
my view, like a take charge man does not.
Do you ever use emojis?
Use emojis? Never.
Oh, never. No. And have you ever attempted to even have it on your keyboard?
Like, you can't delete them.
No, but when you're texting Josh, you probably think, you think he doesn't like you. So you probably should.
That's not true.
Why is he?
Well, first of all, I'm not.
He'll say that's funny.
I limit myself.
Haha. He'll say that's funny, period.
I limit myself to one exclamation point.
Yeah.
Also,
not like
he's
11.
Writer.
Yeah. I'm a fan of like a whole row of exclamation marks.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, so what's the deal
breaker?
So
that's not a deal breaker. Emojis, that's fine.
Okay, deal breakers now. I would say, okay, if the guy's got a drinking problem, that's a deal breaker.
Okay. That's no fun.
Believe it or not, that's not a lot of people don't, they don't,
yeah.
They don't see
this
that
is
that's
all,
on
this
the
is
list.
All, right. This is new things. These are new for me.
Okay.
He's got a drug problem. If he does any kind of drugs, including marijuana every day,
yeah.
That's a deal breaker.
That's a good one.
So where's the line there? Like every other day, that's too much?
I'm if it's multiple times a week, like it's too much.
Once a week. Once a week's all right.
You're really threading the line.
No,
you're really threading the line with
the
once a week drug use.
Works. Okay.
If you are a narcissist, that's a deal breaker. If you're condescending, if you talk down to me, that's a deal breaker. If you don't fucking get your wallet out and pay, that's a deal breaker.
So, okay. So drug abuse.
Yeah,
or,
drug abuse.
Cheapskatism.
Yeah. If you're broke.
Yeah.
That's a deal breaker. Sure.
Yeah, forget about it. If you're broke, I'm not dealing with it. I dated a skater boy who was semi-model, and dude, it was terrible.
Semi-model?
You know, he was on one commercial running on a bike or like getting on a bike, and he thought he was like...
Oh my God, that's so good.
I couldn't do it.
Yeah, if you are unemployed, mm-hmm. that's a deal breaker. If you're a man whore, that's a deal breaker. If you're like bullshit with communicating, like you just send like text messages aimlessly, like not trying to meet up, or it's like it takes you multiple weeks to ask me out and you're texting me all the time. No. If you're married, that's a deal breaker. If you're engaged, that's a deal breaker.
Hit really high standards.
That's funny.
Okay.
And what else?
See, I'm thinking like if a guy orders like a Cosmo or something, like he's out.
Well,
what
that's
drink?
More of a red flag.
What drink?
That's more of a red flag.
So what drinks? Like you're on a date, first date.
Yeah.
It's going pretty well. Like the first few minutes, whatever, right? Like it feels okay. And then, you know, you get to the bar. What drink could a guy order that then sends that date in a different trajectory?
That's a good one.
Yeah. Anything. I mean, now it's like specialty cocktails are such a thing.
Yeah.
You know, mixology and all that. So you can't like knock a guy for ordering a specialty cocktail. It's not like the old days where it's like, you know, could I get a Sex on the Beach or like,
yeah.
Can I get a French martini or like. First of all, no, you can't. Just leave.
Apple martini.
Yeah, apple martini. Kill yourself. No. Why are you alive? But those days are, that's sort of like a dated model. Unless you go to maybe a dive bar.
I feel like mixology kind of came in to save those guys, right?
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to give you.
No, seriously.
Yeah.
Your sweet.
I mean, yeah, it's like if a guy's ordering like a, I mean, who does this anymore? This used to be my signature drink, but like a Long Island iced tea.
Yeah.
You know, which has.
My wife orders Long Island.
Does she?
Sure.
Wow. Yeah. She's the best.
She also drinks Fireball.
She loves Fireball. No, she's great. She could drink whatever she wants.
Yeah, she can drink whatever she wants. Wait, so I'll date your wife.
What's the best advice you've ever been given for dating?
The best advice I've ever been given for dating is...
stay to your kind.
I guess is to be open to the moment.
Yeah.
You know, and to like forget everything you knew before. Mm,
that's a good one.
And something that I have to be reminded of all the time is that when you're dating someone, you have to remember that, like, you don't know them.
Yeah.
They're a stranger. Like, you can, and you can project sure. all kinds of things on them, and you can, you know, have sex with them and, like, think that, you know, whatever you want to think. Mm. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's a stranger. Mm. Like, you don't know him or her. That's something I have to remember all the time.
What about work?
What about work?
Yeah. Best advice you've ever been given.
About work?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, the best advice I've ever been given about work is to have a shell like an armadillo and an inside like a marshmallow, which means that you don't let anyone's negativity or rejection or jealousy or whatever affect you, but to still keep your vulnerability and like your truth.
Mm. Have you had mentors?
Yes.
People help you along the
way? Yeah, I've been really lucky. I've had some awesome mentors. Stephen Adley Girgis is my writing mentor, and he just won a Pulitzer for his play Between Riverside and Crazy, which was at the Atlantic Theater in New York. And he's the creator and executive producer of a new show that's coming to Netflix. It's called The Get Down, and it's about the Boogie Down Bronx and the birth of hip-hop, and Baz Luhrmann's directing the pilot.
Nice.
And Stephen directed my first play in New York, which was called Kiss Me on the Mouth, which was just life-changing for me. Mm. For him to champion me and get behind me and endorse me and, you know, direct my work was truly phenomenal.
How'd you meet him?
I met him. I went to a drama school in New York called the Maggie Flanagan Studio, and Stephen had been a student of Maggie's, and he came in at the end of our 2-year program, and he taught this playwriting for actors workshop, and that's how we met. Mm. He was nice. My teacher.
Any plans to go back to New York?
Yeah, I'm going to go back to New York. At the end of the summer, I'm producing my friend Bixby Elliott, the one who taught me how to make fake jizz. He has written a beautiful play called Summer Fool, and it's about the first gender reassignment surgery. Mm. And it's an incredible story about the man who transitioned to become a woman and his wife and how his wife stayed with him. And it's really about a really beautiful love story. And it's one of the most incredible pieces of theater I've ever read. So I'm going to go back to produce that. So I'm super excited about that.
Nice.
That's yeah. awesome.
Do you have like a goal that you're working towards you know, how will you know when you accomplish what you set out?
How will I know? When I'm like touching people on a global scale, and I'm able to translate my work across like various mediums and people who I've never met before, not like friends of friends, but like real true strangers are able to access my work and for it to have an effect on them. Like that's when I'll feel that I've really accomplished something.
Is there someone, if you could trade places, not in life, but a career. Is there someone whose career you'd like to have?
Oh, whose career would I like to emulate? Mm-hmm. Chelsea Handler, Tina Fey, Louis C.K., Larry David, Mike Birbiglia.
You can do a Chelsea Handler for sure.
I mean, I'm working on it.
Yeah.
I'm working on it. You know, half Asian, less drunk.
Yeah, she's funny.
Right.
I saw her live with Gwyneth Paltrow, LA Live Talks.
How was that?
It was good. Gwyneth Paltrow, I mean, she's cool, but she was a terrible interviewer.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. She's just kind of boring.
Oh.
But I guess Chelsea got to pick who interviewed her, and they're friends, and they've done a ton of things together, social and, you know, personal. So, but anyway, she was great. I love Chelsea Handler live. She was great. Great storyteller.
Awesome.
Nice. Well, maybe you could find her around town and bump her off, and then you can take her place.
That's a great career plan.
Yeah.
Thank you. That'll
then
that'll
make show about it.
Yeah. That'll be my new, like, best piece of advice I've gotten about work.
I see her at Santa Monica Stairs sometimes, so maybe you can, like, ambush
you
her.
You do? That's good. Do you really? I'm surprised you...
Yeah, it's been a while, but yeah. I have seen her there. Mm. I don't go anymore, but...
To the stairs?
Not because of running into Chelsea. It's just I moved, so it's convenient.
It's not convenient anymore. Yeah. I understand.
Yeah. It's not like there's a restraining order
Or
anything.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for doing this with us.
Thanks for having
me.
It's
been fun learning about you. Come back when you have your next thing and let's talk about it.
Yeah, I would love that.
Awesome.
Cool.
Yay.
Cool.
Okay, that was our episode with Melanie Maras. I hope it made you laugh. I know it made me laugh. Hey, that was Cassie, my sometimes co-host. If you liked her, leave us a comment and we'll see if we can bring her back for another one. She's kind of on a hiatus right now, but you never know. See what happens. Hit us on Twitter at Rebel Radio Net. Find us on Facebook and make sure you check out our new YouTube page for our growing catalog of Rebel Radio videos. Radio videos. That's what's up. Come back next week. My guest will be the one and only Shira Lazar with great stories from the world of YouTube. I'll talk to you then.